Greetings, podcast listeners, and welcome to the July edition of the Colorado Review podcast. My name's Daniel Schoening.
And I'm Evan Senny.
And if this is not the most exciting day of the year, it's one of three in which we get to talk about our newest edition, the summer 2019 issue of Colorado Review. Today, we're going to be reading excerpts and responding to wonderful works of poetry from Cedar Brandt, Chelsea Dingman, and Maggie Smith.
We'll also be reading an excerpt from a story by Melanie Ritzenthaler and an essay by Tali Perch.
Stick around. As with every new edition of Colorado Review, the poetry really, really sings clearly. There's a collection of such a multiplicity of voices, of backgrounds, of concerns, and the three that I've chosen today could easily be in the company of any other that is in the edition. So if you like what you heard, I highly recommend that you pick up a copy for yourself. This issue, the poetry selection is curated by Felicia Zamora, an alumna of CSU, about which I'm really excited, and she did an exceptional job finding all those voices and giving them a home here, and so it's wonderful to be able to spread that through this medium.
Likewise, this issue is full of wonderful fiction, and a story I particularly liked is called Catch Claw by Melanie Ritzenthaler. The premise of the story is that the protagonist has a roommate named Lush, and she goes through cycles of relationships. And in the excerpt I'm about to read, her current boyfriend, Caleb, and Lush and the protagonist are crab fishing. For the next hour, as the sun burns the clouds away, Lush crows out to us every time she nets something. When Lush's luck starts to go, she moves farther down the bank, opens another beer, tugs at her empty lines impatiently. By the time Caleb and I have netted 12, the sun is on the back of my neck. That should do it, he says, and I can finally rock back on my heels, running my fingers over the tender grooves that have become ridged into my knees. Caleb crouches down to pack up the cooler. Inside, a couple dozen crabs appear to be dreaming in ice, their claws slowly opening and closing. I picked this passage because the image of the crabs dreaming in ice is what really stuck with me from this story. Mm-hmm. And also because it seemed like a nice moment that was representative of what the story was getting at, about the crabs being in a sort of dreamlike state and something being underneath what's on the surface of this story, which is the rigid structure and the protagonist looking at Lush and analyzing, but really there's this dark thing that's deeper than that that we're getting at.
Yeah, and I think especially images that don't have a clear correlative relationship with that crisis in the work, where it's not a single, even allegorical relationship to she's not the crabs, her love isn't the crabs, but instead it kind of sets this emotional tenor for everything else so that we're left to fixate on it, think about it, reflect on it, but not know precisely what it means in reference to that crisis that we're presented from the outset.
Yeah, and part of what's wonderful about reading fiction, or really any writing that uses image, is that sometimes an image, you just feel the image. Mm-hmm. And I'm not sure I could say exactly why this one stuck with me the way that it did, but immediately I could feel the weight of it in the context of the story. And I think, I don't know exactly how, yeah, but the story was built such that I was primed for that image to really stick.
Yeah. And it, on some level, it's an integral part. It's a pillar within the story, and images like it hold up the rest. But it also feels utterly separate from, that it can stand on its own and penetrate your mind separately in ways that are really eerie in the way that the image itself is eerie.
Exactly.
And I think that it takes a subtle, careful hand in order to implement that. I think it, when we receive it, it feels very easy and organic and straightforward. Like, of course, that must fit right there. Of course, that's the observation that would be made in that moment. But it's really difficult to find something that fits that emotional tenor or advances the crisis without being heavy-handed or without missing the mark altogether.
And I think, while we're on that topic, we should mention, Danny and I were talking about this story earlier, and there's another sort of really nice, subtle move that happens in this section where Lush, when things aren't going well, moves away and tugs on the line impatiently, and the protagonist gets those grooves in her knee from waiting so long in one spot. And they're not too heavy-handed, but they really fit the different ways that these characters move in the world and what the damage can be from moving that way.
And when characterization like that fits so seamlessly, where characters are just acting in this world as they would, where we can believe that they are, not just that they've been constructed to be a certain way. They're not foils. They're not caricatures. I think that the service of that is that it lands without you having to think about it.
Yeah, we're invited to make a bigger meaning out of it, but we aren't pulled away from the story to do that. We can do everything in the context of fully believing what's happening.
Mm-hmm. And as you continue to read this piece, I think it understands, or rather the writer understands, the value of not only that setup and that standalone image, but that eventual payoff. Further down the page, in a moment that we did not yet read, she writes, "The crabs go sour in the heat, letting off a rank, fishy smell. Eventually, at the end of the day, when things have wound down, those things that they have coveted, gathered over the course of the day, that are the pivot point for that haunting image, then are squandered, lost." And likewise, there's no clear allegory or relationship or metaphor at work there that I can tell. There's the vehicle of it isn't screaming out to me, but the tenor is really felt. The emotional effect is present. The first poem that I've chosen to read an excerpt from that I found so profoundly affecting, I think, merits very little response from me and Evan. I really think that the words speak for themselves so brilliantly and heartbreakingly. And I'm only going to read a small segment. I highly, highly recommend, if folks don't read anything else from this selection, Book of Silver by Cedar Brandt is absolutely stunning. Book of Silver, August. I wake the third morning with this new knowledge, an accrual, not of words, but of cells, a little wing of joy in my heart, a dream that may be opening the universe slowly inside my body. It opens. I don't feel you, little one. Is your spirit near? Are you a dawn? A light that starts out almost night, then slowly blues the edges, a spanning of gradual embodiment. It is my job, then, to feed, to make safe a new cove of blood and bone. Now it is just the beginning of a shape that might shelter you in a body one day. A poem that is my body, with a room that is your body. September. Now these new dry mountains, out of whose clefts gush the sun each morning. The cactus, the snails eat the green pads of. The sound of the tangled freeways each dark morning through my open window. It is all I can do to just be, a kind of presence, each day that is holding open a space for you. On Wednesday, we first heard your heartbeat. A quick pita, 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 before you swam away from the machine. To hear your heart beating away in there, to listen in, to know you are alive and not just a story we make up about bodies. I feel quiet with so much gratitude. And like I said, it really does speak for itself, and it just moves in directions and through images and voice and structures and thoughts that are absolutely earth-shattering. I have very little to say other than that I think there's such an attuned sense of precise truth, that lowercase t truth that is felt as much as it's known. And I think that the metaphor and image services so, so serenely an access point to something that otherwise is utterly beyond me. And I think that's the mark of something that really is going to last. obviously among many in this collection, is Chelsea Dingman's Because We Can Never Know All the Initial Conditions of a Complex System in Sufficient Detail, We Cannot Hope to Predict the Ultimate Fate of a Complex System. I think I know the decapitated sonnet you escaped from. The argument without resolution is called life. Who can survive strict forms stripped of an ending? Acid and weed, then cocaine. Your body, another throwaway line striping tile in a bathroom when last I saw you. You did not speak, but exploded into sound. I want to say I survived our childhoods, but I hate that I survived you. Little brother, the sky is bright with surrender tonight. Your hands are cold. The world flickers in the distance. All that is left of time.
Holy shit.
I know.
Jeez. I love that poem. Yeah. And I love the title. What a title.
Absolutely.
Wow.
Frank O'Hara is the poet I first think of when I think of long titles that are themselves integral parts of the work. Obviously, any title of a poem, or most titles of poems, if they are titled integral parts of works. But here, it's precisely establishing a voice and a worldview and a structure that we are then entering into to both be expanded and built upon, but also subverted with the emotional, authentic, personal voice that supplements it.
Yeah. It really comes through because in the title, it seems like it's making the point that we can't predict the ultimate fate, but you're at such a distance reading that, and then you're so close, and it's so devastating the way it feels hearing the poem.
Mm-hmm.
It just was very affecting.
Yeah. And even the narrative distance of the work, to use the fictive term, because we can never know is speaking in terms of we as a species, we as thinkers, as minds, is bringing in into the fold both reader and writer implicitly. But then in the poem itself, I and you, it's an I, thou. But the you is particular. It's not a general. It's not an audience you. But still, it places us in a place of profound intimacy with the speaker in ways that are utterly disarming and so fruitful at close.
And the moment when it goes to, I want to say I survived our childhoods, I really felt that deeply, that it was two people, but this one experience. I don't know.
Yeah. And I think that the almost synesthetic subversion of image that comes in the penultimate stanza, little brother, the sky is bright with surrender tonight. Your hands are cold. There's this profound weaving of senses, of sensory detail. Your hands are cold. We're meant to engage the I, thou, and the thou that has now departed, but also keep our mind's eye on that cosmic scale alluded to at title. The sky is bright, but what is it bright with? Surrender. I think that's something that's profoundly difficult to do correctly in a poem, to do in a way that affects its audience, because the abstraction of bright with surrender, I think in many works would be impossible to engage. We wouldn't know what that looks like, what that feels like. But this piece warrants it so, so deftly as the piece accumulates, it accrues, it grows. And I think it really, really lands in ways that are heartbreaking.
Yeah. And it seemed to me that the final line, all that is left of time, on its own could fit in the voice of the title, but it doesn't anymore because of what we just read leading up to it.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's the whole kit and caboodle of poetry, right? You return and you return changed.
Yeah.
Yeah. And lastly, from the poetry section of the latest issue of Colorado Review, I'm going to read Maggie Smith's Talk of Horses. Funny what swims up in the mind. Sample lipsticks, thimble-sized, that the Avon lady handed my mother at our front door. We lived on Lilacwood Avenue. I was 4 or 5, maybe even younger. eyeing the pinks, reds, corals the size of my pinky tip. When we lived in that house, I remember visiting my aunt and uncle in the country. They had cherry trees. I can see myself under them, looking up into the branches. My grandfather lived in the country, too, in a big house with his new wife. Didn't they have horses? While my grandmother rented a small apartment in the city, near the shopping mall where she worked. All these pieces, what do they add up to? Tiny lipsticks, cherry trees, talk of horses I don't think I saw at the house where my grandfather lived with his third wife, the one who seemed so dazed we secretly called her the spun pheasant. Later, my grandfather lost almost everything in their divorce. Later, my grandmother lost almost everything in her mind. But a few memories swam up now and then to wake her. All these pieces. If this were a mystery, we'd consider them clues. But isn't this a mystery?
I'm not sure I've ever heard a more full of disdain way for kids to describe a person as the spun pheasant.
The spun pheasant. It's pretty great. What a wonderfully distilled voice of a child, the incisive, cutting way.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think the whole work, I think that it does something that I often turn to memoir in order to satiate, where it enacts and comments upon the shortcomings and features of memory, building and rebuilding and remaking and second guessing that takes place and is often hidden in other forms of writing. That here these things are very much swimming up in the mind. And swimming up are not just narratives, but images. And those images themselves are talismans to what happened and when. And I think that's such an organic, honest way by which we interact with the world of our pasts.
Yeah, and it's, like you said, smart to have the tie, you know, the mind that is falling apart later in the poem, but then earlier we start with the pieces that are there, the cherry tree and all of that. And so it's very carefully laid out so that we can understand what might come up and how we have to make meaning out of that and how it is a mystery. Memory is always a mystery.
And that dual meaning of mystery that's provided so wonderfully at close, that something can at once be a mystery that clues must be added up to in order to solve. But something's also a cosmic mystery. It's something that is deserving of our wonder and awe, and that these clues, in addition to adding up to an answer, are more so part of that process of living. We lived on Lilac Wood Avenue, I think, is everyone has a Lilac Wood Avenue. Everyone has sample lipsticks, thimble size, that the Avon lady handed my mother. That's exactly right. And I think it's perfectly tied to an era, a moment, an experience that's so personal but avoids the nostalgic. And I think nostalgia by its definition is exclusive, is personal, and doesn't have room for a reader. And here it moves beautifully into a generalizable while still affecting and experienceable thought process. As ever, at Colorado Review and the Center for Literary Publishing, there is lots going on in addition to this podcast. Brandon Creed's Magnifier was chosen by Judge Kazem Ali as the winner of the 2019 Colorado Prize for Poetry, which is forthcoming in November of 2019. As those listening to this episode are hopefully aware, the new issue of Colorado Review from the summer of 2019 is available at the Colorado Review website at coloradoreview.colostate.edu under the tab marked Bookstore. While you're there, you can find recent collections of poetry, including Furthest Ecology by Adam Fagan as part of the Mountain West Poetry Series, and last year's winner of the Colorado Prize for Poetry, Gillian Cummings's The Owl Was a Baker's Daughter.
Also on our website, you can find our blog, book reviews, and featured poetry and prose from the latest edition of Colorado Review.
And now, more from the latest issue.
Finally, we're going to talk about an essay by Tali Perch called Records on Bone. The essay is about a narrator who moves from Ukraine to the United States, to Newark, with her family when she's a little kid. And it's about Americanness and feeling other, and about sharing feelings and what can be shared and what has to get left behind, and how that affects the ability of a family to connect to each other. I turn these tales over in my head now as I watch Dad's face bathed in the television's blue light. I realize suddenly that I have always transposed the image of my younger father over the aging one. For me, my father has always been frozen in time as the young 20-something from my childhood and adolescence, wearing his hair in a fro, his torso sinewy and concave, his face carved from stone. And always when he is near, I become a bumbling, wordless 5-year-old with the girl version of his wild, unruly hair. We two together, a young dad and his small daughter, in suspended animation. But watching the nostalgic look on his face as he takes in Vysotsky singing about time racing by like the draft of a troika, I can admit to myself for the first time that Dad is getting old. I can see that his glorious fro has been replaced by a silver, downy fluff, and the once concave belly is inflated from decades of imbibing wine and vodka and enjoying Mom's enormous Jewish portions. My daughter eyes try hard not to see this new, weighty man with wrinkles and hillocky shoulders. There was a time when, if you told me you saw Dad soaring through the sky on nothing but air, I'd have required no proof whatsoever to believe you. But then again, here is his face in this moment, soft, sad, vulnerable, easier to love than a face made of stone. I picked this excerpt because, for me, a pleasure of this essay was learning all sorts of things about growing up in Ukraine, interesting facts about history and what it's like to be in the United States, and that was all wonderful. But then in this excerpt, it feels like it distills down to the core of what's being talked about, the really poignant and rich relationship between the speaker and her father, and in the rest of the essay also her mother. But it just felt like it was such a beautiful encapsulation of it all in one little chunk.
Mm-hmm. And it's not one thing. And I think the speaker so wonderfully doesn't arrive at one conclusion for any of the facets that she's bringing to our attention, that the suspended animation that's alluded to is at once something kind of romanticized, but also something grim that becomes bumbling, bobbling, whatever that word was, in reference to her father whenever they speak. But then a soft face is more lovable than one that's made of stone, that there are trade-offs and exchanges, and that at minimum there's a change taking place, not that we need a singular experience of what that change is.
And I also wanted to pick an excerpt that mentions Vysotsky, because that was it was such a pleasure to read about this singer who the narrator calls the Russian Bob Dylan. And it was just interesting to read, but then also the connection between Vysotsky and the narrator's father, and the image of him watching it and his eyes sort of tearing up watching a music video, essentially, of Vysotsky singing in the sort of desperation in his voice when he sings. And he sings these words that the narrator doesn't understand because she doesn't speak Russian. But she can tell that there's like a wildness in him that is also in her dad, or that was in her dad. Mm-hmm. And it's really beautiful. And so I wanted to get that in there. I hope you'll read this essay. And there's just a whole lot of just fascinating, poignant stuff in here.
And I think that's one of the wonderful access points for especially this being a on some level, the immigrant experience for the States, for Newark, New Jersey at minimum. It also is an explanation and exploration of what makes up a nation or a home or an origin, where in addition to it being a collection of people, it's Vysotsky and a particular cultural background, a shared experience of this singer or of this Olympian or whatever else. it's also the personal memory of our speaker's father in this context, in this moment, that he on some level is the epitomization of Ukraine. And because her experience of it is after the point of their moving to the United States through him. Him is a vestige of that. And so the kind of pointillism, the access point of each feature of her father becomes an access point to that larger culture, that background, that thing that's lost or perhaps fading for her. Well, that was an incredible collection of writers, and it really, it sounds like fluff, but very much this is chock full of folks that we wish we had the chance to talk about, and perhaps will in future podcasts, but I couldn't more highly recommend picking up a copy of this latest issue of Colorado Review. Thank you to everyone who listened and carried with us this long. Thank you to Stephanie Geschwind, Editor-in-Chief of Colorado Review, for this space, this equipment, this opportunity to work on this podcast that we have so much affection for.
And also to Arnie Geschwind, who composed the music that you heard on this episode. He's a great guy.
He is a great guy.
I mean, funny dude. He's got a lot of guitars. He plays great music. What's not to like?
Everyone, in addition to buying this issue of Colorado Review, look up Arnie Geschwind.
Just say hi to him.
Just say hi. This has been Daniel Schoening.
And Evan Senny.
We hope you'll join us again here in August.